going with Truth News Radio Australia. It's Thursday, the 21st of May, 2009. And I'm your host, Herewood Fenton. Well, we have an extremely important broadcast for you tonight. Tonight I'll be interviewing Dr. David Leifer from the University of Sydney. Dr. David Leifer is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Architecture at the University of Sydney, and he is one of the most important and outspoken members of the Australian 9/11 Truth Movement. Dr. Leifer will be giving a public lecture at the university, which we'll mention the details during the interview. It's on the 4th of June, but we'll give you all the details during the interview. And he'll be talking about his research, specifically into the collapse of WTC Tower 1, the North Tower. So this is a really important show, folks, and I hope that you pass this on to other people and hope that everyone listening can appreciate the importance of this broadcast. Well, tonight, I am very, very pleased to have with me on Truth News Radio Dr. David Leifer from the University of Sydney. Dr. Leifer is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Architecture and Planning at Sydney University. He is a registered architect and an incorporated engineer, and he is one of our most eminent and important Australian critics of the official view of the collapse of the World Trade Center, which is a pivotal piece of information in relation to many, many other issues relating to what really happened on September 11. It's really the core of the 9/11 Truth Movement tends to be the questions that revolve around what happened to the World Trade Center. Now, in saying that, I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that that is what the 9/11 Truth Movement is all about. It's simply that with respect to the collapse of the towers, we have such a glaring inconsistency between what we've been told, what is the official story of 9/11, and what has been observed and what is now increasingly becoming scientifically proven through research and study. So, Dr. Leifer, welcome to Truth News. It's really great to have you with us. And as I was saying, you know, your work and your input is extremely important. I mean, it can't be overemphasized in terms of how important it is. And I think what I'd really like to concentrate on this interview is for the person who is perhaps coming to this subject for the first time, I always like to give them a sense that they can get an expert's view that's not going to overwhelm them with too much information or too much detail, but which is going to be able to articulate the key points. And this is our goal with the 9/11 Truth Movement, is to try and educate more and more people. And it's tricky because we have this problem of technical expertise, and a lot of people just say, well, you know, I can't comment. I don't know how the building fell. I'm not an engineer. Therefore, I won't even think about it. Now, I'm just wondering if you can say anything to that point, because that tends to be one of the biggest problems that I've found in discussing this generally with members of the public.
There are two problems. First one is that, by and large, we tend to end up talking to people who are already sceptical. And the trouble is to reach people who have not thought it necessary to question the official version of events. But there are much more eminent physicists and engineers than myself who have done all the pioneering work and risked more than I. But my take on it is this, and I'll try and put this as a simple illustration. If you can imagine that we have 110 concrete slabs sitting in the air, regularly spaced, going up 417 meters. So in other words, we have all the floor plates of the World Trade Center, but no columns. That's a very, very simple model.
Sure.
And if you then take the top 12 floors and you, acting as a block, and you drop them, what happens is, of course, the top 12 floors will drop and collide with the 13th, and then the 13 floors will drop and collide with the 14th, and right the way down the building. Now, we can model that using Newton's laws of gravity and the conservation of momentum. It's quite a simple calculation. Most year 12 high school students could do that.
Yes.
And what we find is that you cannot get those floors to collapse to the ground in less than 12 seconds or so.
Okay.
Now, that means, since we know that the building came down in about 11 seconds or no more, there must be more energy involved in that system to make it fall down in 12 seconds. Where did that energy come from? The official explanation says there's only gravity working, but the physics say you have to add energy.
Okay, okay. Can I just take a devil's advocate position for one moment?
Certainly.
And in relation to the 12 seconds versus the 11 seconds, a lot of people might say, well, a second's difference, I mean, is that really, you know, maybe there's just a problem with the way it was measured, or, you know, I mean, it doesn't sound like a big deal. Okay, the fastest it could happen.
It doesn't sound like a big deal,
yeah.
But I have to increase the force of gravity by 50% to make it come down in the appropriate time. In other words, the constant of terrestrial gravitation is 9.81 meters per second squared. To get it down in the time that we're told it came, well, we know that it came down, we have to increase gravity to 15 meters per second squared.
That is
physically impossible.
So we really are coming up against some hard laws of Newtonian mechanics here.
It's unequivocal. There is no explanation for it other than the fact that more energy has to be added to the system to account for it to come down in the time it did.
So this what this raises the question of is, okay, that in addition to this problem of, well, the actual collapse exceeds gravitational acceleration. Am I saying that correctly?
It doesn't exceed gravitational acceleration. What it is, it cannot go through the mechanisms of conservation of energy and gravitational collapse.
Right,
something's wrong.
I see. Yeah. So, in the example that you were proposing, you're saying, like, in the absence of any other resistance, even if it was just floors pancaking down on each other.
Even if we, in my model, I've ignored the existence of columns.
Right.
And remember, there
okay.
are 93
yeah.
extant undamaged floors.
Yes.
Below the thing.
Yes.
It's just whatever model you take is going to be more complex. The collapse would be much slower.
Indeed. Yes. Once we introduce the vertical columns resisting the collapse and the structural integrity of the building, then the 11-second collapse becomes just astronomically quicker than is explicable.
Oh, it's just impossible.
Yeah,
more energy in my model. If the only energy there is due to gravity, then that energy is bled off by the need to smash the columns out the way, the need to pulverize the concrete, the need to snap all the junctions, and in fact the concrete floors are suspended on steel beams, a network of steel beams, which have to be squashed. There is in fact just no way that gravity alone can account for what happened.
Indeed, and of course then we have the complete virtual pulverization of all the concrete? Something like, what, 80% of the concrete was pulverized? Or
is that... I honestly don't know what that the correct number is, but we know from all, we've seen the dust clouds. I have tried to, I've built some concrete test cubes and dropped them 18.6 meters, which was as high as I could get safely, to see whether I could get the concrete to pulverize, and 5% I could get, 5% of the concrete was pulverized or could not be accounted for.
Right. So from your knowledge and your expertise, there is really no way that there's no mechanism, you know, that involves aircraft damage followed by fires, even with the stripping off of the fireproofing, as they said, that could allow this to occur. I mean, a lot of people have pointed out that, you know, asymmetrical damage, totally symmetrical collapse, again, you know, highly improbable to say the least. That we see the speed of the collapse. We see the destruction of the complete destruction of the materials. Now, of course, another point that's often brought up by the so-called debunkers of the 9/11 truth movement is they'd say, well, you know, it's just not possible that it's not practical or possible to put explosives into a building and rig it up that way. And, you know, they say, well, you know, and the plane would have flown into the building and would have ruined your perfect timing of your explosives. And they sort of say, well, how do you explain that? And they always sort of say, how do you explain this? How do you explain that? But the main thing, I think, being that they cannot conceive that a conspiracy so vast, you know, that phrase is often brought up. What's the best way to address that, do you think?
Oh, you raised a number of interesting points.
Yeah.
Now, the first, you're right. The theories that are put forward are so enormous in magnitude. No one really wants to go there.
Yeah.
But my starting point was the cigar tube of an aeroplane that ran into the World Trade Centers. Fragmented on impact.
Yes.
And really, it was flying into hollow steel columns and glass. So
yes.
It was kind of a lightweight...
Made of aluminium, which is... A cigar tube is made of aluminium.
Was made of aluminium,
indeed.
But it ran into a wall that was, as I say, hollow steel columns and glass. And it impacted and it fragmented to a million fragments, according to the NIST report.
Yes.
Yet the same type of cigar tube, whatever, was supposed to have hit the Pentagon, and it penetrated six heavy concrete walls.
Well, that's a very interesting point.
Well, that's the first thing that alerted me, the fact that something was wrong, because there was just the damage is so different.
Yeah.
Obviously, that they are not the same projectiles that. Same type of projectiles that hit the two buildings.
Right.
And that caused me to start looking at some of the other features of the World Trade Center collapses. And as I say, there are a number of improbabilities.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The physical impossibility that I've described, the fact that you can't bring the buildings down without adding energy, you can't bring them down in 10 or 11 seconds, that is proof positive that something else was going on. And we have not had an explanation as to where this additional energy could have come from. And the only technology that I know of that can achieve that result is controlled demolition.
Okay, yeah. Are you across the paper that was recently... released by Niels Harrit and Stephen Jones.
Yeah, the one about thermitic materials.
Yes.
Found. Absolutely.
And
I'm quoting that these days, yeah.
Great, great, yeah. And, I mean, that paper has obviously been a bit of a breakthrough in the sense that it is published in a peer-reviewed journal. it's not saying anything that we didn't already, you know, strongly suspect a long time ago, but I think the fact that they've done the research and they've put it through that whole process is going to be a big it's a change. We're moving to a new phase of this. Okay, so we're really talking about a unique form of controlled demolition. We're not talking about a standard form of controlled demolition.
Well, one of the things you alluded to is the fact that people were saying, oh, they couldn't, whatever, you know, can organise that. I think the personally, and this is only an assertion and an opinion on my part, the reason that the World Trade Center 2 stood for 52 or 56 minutes, whatever it was, and World Trade Center 1 was 108, was that it took that long for whoever was controlling the demolition to reprogram the detonators to make them simulate collapse under gravity.
Right, right. So there was a manual aspect to it in terms of where they started the collapse.
Well, unless they knew, I mean, ideally they would like to pinpoint where the planes were going to hit.
Yeah.
So then as soon as the planes hit, they could have demolished it, and then it would have been kind of like a done deal. No one would question that it wasn't the planes that caused the collapse. But, of course, not being quite sure where the planes hit, if they were not sure, then they would have to reprogram the detonators in such a way as to allow for where the planes hit and then take it from there.
Okay, okay. So in your comment earlier, you were saying that your beginnings of your interest in this was comparing the Pentagon damage with the World Trade Center damage. I'm just interested to explore that a little bit more. Are you suggesting that the damage to the Pentagon suggests that it wasn't a plane? I mean, it's probably not a subject we want to get into unless you want to. But were you actually proposing there that what hit the Pentagon doesn't look like?
It was certainly, without question, a different, I'll use the term missile.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a different missile to the planes that hit the World Trade Center.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting point that, you know, you compare the two, and they were both the same type of aircraft traveling at a similar speed.
That's what we're told.
Yeah, and the Pentagon had this incredible reinforcement, this massive reinforcement.
But look, the real thing is, if the FBI confiscated, 86 CCTV cameras around the place,
yes,
and they have not produced one that definitively shows an aeroplane going into the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And if they had that, you know, if there had been a plane, it's impossible, given the distance away that the various cameras are and the fact they will be pointing in different directions, it's impossible to conceive that they would not have caught something that they could be placed before the public to say this is what happened. Quite clearly, because they haven't presented that information, I would say it doesn't exist. Therefore, we have to look at alternatives.
Yes, and you know, to me, that's always been the most important argument questioning what happened at the Pentagon, is the refusal of the government to show us some video footage.
No, it would prove that, I mean, if it existed, it would prove conclusively, and there wouldn't be a problem. I just do not understand.
Yeah.
Also, the only explanation is that they just don't have that evidence.
Well, of course, they did release that very blurry footage.
Oh, no, but it didn't show anything, did it?
Yeah, no, it all you could see was some smoke.
Well, there was meant to be the nose of the projectile on the right-hand side of one frame, and next thing, there's a fireball.
Yeah, yeah, so... Yeah, so, you know, we don't have to... I mean, you know, as citizens, we need to have justice. We need to have an investigation. Of course, we will speculate and theorise. It's only human nature to speculate when you're given an obviously false story. But, of course, this tendency of people to want to speculate and theorise is then kind of mocked and ridiculed by the press. And this phenomenon of, you know, the simple nature of people wanting to explain what they can't understand then becomes termed conspiracy theory, and we go round and round in circles with this pointless this game that just seems to and it seems to go on year after year after year, and we've seen it with other events that have occurred in history too.
Absolutely. In fact, look, we've been subject to three major crimes.
Yeah.
The first was the attack on the Pentagon by terrorists. Sorry, the first was the 9/11 attacks.
Yes.
Period. The second was the deliberate attempt by the inquiries, the FEMA, the 9/11 Commission, the NISTRIPOL, all deliberately have dispensed false or ambiguous information. And the third crime is the way the media have abrogated their responsibility to dispassionately examine the stories and the evidence that have been accumulated. And the big surprise is just how effective the obfuscation of the various official reports has been propagated. It's worked. It's shut people up. And people, as you rightly point out, who question the veracity of those reports are marginalized and scathingly called conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
We have difficulty in reaching the unconverted.
And of course, look, as a technique of political repression, it's not that original. I mean, say compared to the Soviet Union, people who were dissidents were told they were mentally ill, and they were often put in psychiatric institutions, and sometimes forcibly medicated. You know, being a dissident, being someone who goes against the government, leads to various forms of repression. I mean, you know, I guess in some ways we're lucky that we're not, put in prison. I mean, we're not put in political prisons. You could say, well, we've got the freedom to speak. And I do think that we do have certain freedoms here. But I think that unless we exercise those freedoms, it's sort of pointless having them. And that's why we do this radio show. That's why Truth News Radio exists. I'm filling a vacuum. I didn't learn to do this. I wasn't trained to do this. I've had to learn over the last few years how to do some of these things, and I'm gradually getting better at it. But we've basically had to fill a vacuum.
This is true. One of the things about being an academic, a university academic, is you have first and foremost, a responsibility to promulgate the truth.
Yes.
And I take my hat off to people like Steve Jones and David Ray Griffith, who've lost their jobs because they have sort of decided that it's more ethically more important to stand by the truth than go along with the propagation of lies. And a minority, but there are people out there who also feel the ethical necessity of demanding truth. And that's what we want, a dispassionate, unbiased inquiries into what was going on or what happened, so that we can be informed, we can rest easy. I mean, we were all sitting there watching the TV screens, and 3,000 people died, 3,000 people were murdered. It really is alarming, and we should be demanding a truthful explanation of what happened.
Indeed. I mean, the scope of it is really more staggering and more incredible than I can properly articulate. And to me, it's the most important topic on my agenda. We're doing a lot of stuff on this radio show, and a lot of stuff I feel pretty passionately about. But this is just so, it's central, it's key, and we just have to keep communicating the information. We just have to, and one of the things I'm finding talking to random new people that I've met is that a lot of people are pretty aware now that there is some funny business going on with 9/11. In fact, most people are. But a response I've got from many people is they just think, well, it's something from the past, and they go, oh, what are you even bothering with that anymore?
I mean, this is what I was saying, it's been so successful. Now people are considering that it's history. But, you know, it's interesting, in 1961, Eisenhower warned the American population of the emergence of the industrial military government complex.
Yes, yes,
and
indeed.
Just because he outed them, they haven't gone away. And you have to ask yourself, well, who's benefited from the events? And I think you end up talking about conspiracy theories.
Yes,
You know, and it's not necessarily a conspiracy. I was just reading this. A book just come out by, what was it, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Fascinating.
And he makes the point, now, it isn't a conspiracy as such, it's just that a lot of powerful corporations moving in the same direction, so have a similar kind of policies, even if they're not actually collaborating. Definitely, and they're also being aided and abetted by whatever. So I think we're in a very ominous time when power has been transferred to global companies who can move to wherever the laws allow them to get away with whatever they get away with.
Yeah.
And I think what we're fighting against is exactly that.
Yeah, it's the dark side of globalization. I mean, you know, there are some positive things about globalization in terms of communication and knowledge, but the dark side of it is this centralization of power.
As long as the powers that be don't get ownership of the internet,
yes,
and people can communicate and group themselves to fight various things, then that's okay. But I mean, there's a lot of unknowns about it. I imagine we've wandered quite away from World Trade Center 1, but I think this was just
indeed. Well, no, I mean, we should get back there. Actually, I'm just curious to know, at the University of Sydney, have you had a chance to discuss this with colleagues there? Because that's something that a lot of people are curious about.
I'm giving a public lecture on the 6th of June.
Yes.
And I'm hoping to attract students and staff, and then we'll see what the reactions are.
Now,
I think that,
yes,
you know, if you present it in the way I'm doing it, I'm just talking about this business of the energy balance and the fact you need to have energy, because that's irrefutable.
Yes.
And if you can get people to grasp that, then I think they then are faced with the necessity to explain it.
Right, right, okay. And now, is this lecture open to members of the public, listeners to the radio show?
It is a public lecture, but I'm rather hoping that it will be people who disagree who come along, not people who actually already support the principles.
Right, right. I understand. Well, is it something we can put on the show tonight? Can we give the information out?
Well, it's a public lecture, so yeah.
So that's the 6th of June, 2009.
6th of June, yep. In the architecture building,
architecture,
which is 148 City Road.
Right.
6:30 to 8.
Right, 6:30 to 8.
And it's entitled The Life and Death of World Trade Center 1.
Life and Death. Okay, so, and that's of course free, it's just a public lecture. Yeah. I'm certainly going to try and make it to that. I'm sure it'll be extremely worthwhile. Have you had any, you know, informal chats with people in the Faculty of Architecture about this?
I've just submitted an article to the Well, I've had an abstract accepted, and today I just sent off a paper
right.
to the Australian New Zealand Architectural Science Association, and hopefully that will reach architectural scientists around
Right.
Around the globe. It's going
Right.
to, well, at least the region.
Okay,
And
okay.
we'll see. I was actually quite surprised that they accepted the abstract, so that's a good start. But no, I have not really discussed it with people do not want to know about this.
This can be quite isolating, do you find? I mean, you know, it's something that you consider quite important, and it's
I
hard
consider
to
it
talk
very
about it with
important. It's
colleagues.
my research area now, but
Yeah.
academia is a funny place.
Yeah. Okay, well, hopefully after this lecture and with your article hopefully coming out, that, I mean, people really should be talking about it. I can't understand how someone who is a professional in the field of construction and architecture and engineering would not be deeply concerned about this. And if they accept the official view, then they should be deeply concerned that there are all these steel frame buildings that could potentially disintegrate in the same manner as buildings 1, 2, and 7 in the World Trade Center complex. I mean, this should be extremely disturbing to someone who values their profession.
Well, I think someone's made the point before that if the official story had any merit, then everyone would be re-examining building codes, and
right.
it hasn't happened.
Well,
so I think that people have just sort of kind of placed it in the background, and no one has really, or unless you actually really analyse what happened and what's in the reports, you're not going to run with it. Unless someone sticks it under your nose, which is exactly what you and I have to do.
Indeed, yeah. And so there haven't actually been changes to building codes, because I do remember hearing talk about it, but in practice they haven't?
Not here, no.
Okay. And, I mean, do we have steel frame office towers here in Sydney?
Not many. Mostly, right. Australia's much uses reinforced concrete.
Okay, right, yeah, right.
Pardon me.
Now, your lecture is the life and death of WTC 1, is
one.
It? Yeah, okay. So you've decided to focus on that building,
yeah.
In more detail.
Yeah.
And that was the second building to come down, right?
Yeah.
So. Well, that's interesting. Now, that was the one that, you know, we sort of, everyone knew, kind of everyone was ready for it. The first one was like a total shock. And then when the second one came down, it was, you know, it was like, okay, you know. What have you been able to learn about, if you can just maybe give us a very, you know, schematic overview of what you've learned about Building 1?
Well, as I was saying, look, the anomalies are, forgetting the energy balance,
yes.
The building started to collapse from level 98, which is several stories above the point of maximum damage. You would expect it to start collapsing from where the maximum damage was. On level 98, only two columns are damaged.
Right.
Yet
right.
All of them collapse simultaneously, so that's improbable. The fact that it started falling over backwards, the plane hit the north, in the north face, the north face was damaged, yet according to the NIST report, the top of the building started falling to the south.
Right.
And that's another improbability. The fact that all the joints were severed simultaneously, another improbability. And by the time you multiply these improbabilities together, it becomes an impossibility. The odds against us are humongous.
Extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, yeah, the amount of joints and connections that have to be broken simultaneously for something like that to occur. You were saying level 98 was above the actual impact?
Yes.
Okay, so...
it's just about the top of the impact.
Right. So, okay, that is interesting, isn't it? So that was where it first started to move down at that point.
Well, that's where the photographs photographic evidence show.
Right.
All the columns on around the perimeter snap simultaneously. Steel under compression does not snap. The other thing was that the panels were the external column panels are three stories high and three columns wide. You would expect it to snap at the junctions, not snap part way along. So that's another improbability. There's just so much going on there that says this ain't right.
Yeah. I mean, look, a lot of us have, you know, been saying this for years. And, like, I've actually been researching this since before there were any known groups of engineers and architects, before AE911truth.org existed. And, you know, I was posting on forums and people were saying, oh, you know, what do you know? And then they would say, you know, because there were always these debunkers around. It's extraordinary. There's always been on internet forums these people who, you know, put down just a really insulting and derogatory towards those who question. And you know, they used to always sort of say, well, there are no architects and engineers that have said anything. Well, you know, they don't say that anymore. They certainly don't say that anymore. We've got, what's the current count at AE911?
Getting on for 1,000.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of the number of architects who've actually stood up for the official story, well, I mean, what do we really have? I mean, we don't have a lot of them sort of willing to put their names down on petitions, do we?
I don't think there are any people who have stood up apart from the writers of the reports. I don't think there's anyone really who's stood up and said this is how it was. I'm sort of running out of time here, so
that's fine. That's fine. Look, it's been an excellent, excellent opportunity to catch up with you, and to just to let everyone know about this interview, about this lecture you're giving on the 6th of June. So I'll be looking forward to that. And look, I just wanted to really say thank you so much for what you've done. You're still unique in Australia, I think. I mean, we've got some great people, but we don't have people in your particular profession.
As I say, other people have been much braver and bigger about this than I. I take my hat off to them, and it's their example that kind of makes you follow on. But, yeah, it's... I think we need to praise them, not me.
Excellent.
Anyhow, I hope to see you on the 6th.
Absolutely. And look, thank you again so much, and good night.
Of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin. Guided by a signal in the heavens,
guided.
I'm guided by this birthmark on my skin.
I am guided by.
I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons. First, we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin.
I really like to live inside you, baby. I love your body and your
Now you love me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline. How many nights I prayed for this, to let my work begin. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. I don't like your fashion business, mister. And I don't like these drugs that keep you thin. I don't like what happened to my sister. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. Plywood violin. I practiced every night. Now I'm ready. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. Remember me, I used to live for music. Remember me, I brought your groceries in. Well, it's Father's Day and everybody's wounded. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
Well, we are back. Truth News Radio is blasting out into the ether, into the cyberspace, into the nooks and crannies of the universe. And Josh is back with us. Welcome back, Josh.
Harewood, it's such a lovely evening. It's windy outside. It's pouring with rain. And so it's nice to be in the studio.
Safe and warm with a mug of hot cocoa.
Yes, a mug of rooibos tea.
I should say before I forget to acknowledge the previous song there, that was by Leonard Cohen, First We Take Manhattan, a pretty kick-ass song too, actually.
That's great. Oh, yeah. Bobbing my head.
Loving yeah, it. Yeah. It's from an album from about mid-1980s. Yeah, he certainly knew how to, you know, write some very clever lyrics, that guy.
He recently toured in Australia.
He was in Sydney not too long ago. One of these days I might catch one of these great heroes of, one of these great people. I've never seen any of these people live, Dylan, Cohen,
Oh, shame.
Shame upon me, yeah. But I say to myself, well, I can listen to the album and, I get better sound quality that way. Anyway, look, We have some absolutely juicy stories tonight, some really hardcore, you know, R-rated truth to get to you. And by the way, we just had the most incredible interview with Dr. David Leifer.
Folks, Dr. David Leifer, he's a true hero here in Australia, along with Frank Legg. Really, you know, pushing the boundaries of the scientific, the true science that is 9/11 truth, the forensic evidence, if you will, of the aftermath of 9/11, and to really push the truth out, to get some answers, using the facts of science,
yeah,
and the maths. I mean, the maths that Dr. Leifer explained at the last conference was really just a real eye opener, and it was delivered in a way that the layman could actually associate with it. So it wasn't just, you know, hardcore algebraic sort of formulas. It was, you know,
it was scientific, but yet discernible by the average person.
Yeah, so you know, you got these hardcore algorithms there, but formulas. But he'll talk through them very simply and explain exactly what they mean. And it's he's a very good speaker, and I can't wait to see him at the next event.
Look, in fact, the next event is very, very close. He's speaking at the University of Sydney, believe it or not, on the 6th of June.
Yeah, folks, so get along there and tell your friends, your family.
Yeah, he'll be speaking there at the 6th of June. I'm having a little trouble with my computer. I hope it doesn't go down. I keep getting blackouts here. He will be speaking on the 6th of June between 6:30 and 8:30 at the Faculty of Architecture.
So, folks, I would really if anyone has friends that are architects and engineers, please invite them along because, you know, we need more and more. The more scientists we can get and professionals and architects and engineers, the better. So anyone, you know, and Dr. Leifer is very open to discussion and to, you know, getting some feedback, as we all are, because as a lover of science, you want to be refuted. You want to be told that that's wrong and that you can try to explain your way out of it.
He enjoys a challenge, yeah. And he looks forward to having debates. And he's an Australian. I mean, he's an Australian resident. He's from the UK originally, but he's he's an Australian resident. You know, the only one we've got in the discipline of architecture in the academic world who's speaking out here. It's so important. He's very, very important. That's what I keep saying. You know, shame on all the others who haven't spoken out, you know. I'm sorry, but I can't treat them all with kid gloves because there are plenty who know. And,
well, you know,
we want them to speak out, okay? And we want you to feel uncomfortable, okay? We want you to feel a little bit guilty. If you know about this and you're a professional, you have to speak out.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Harold.
We don't have time to bandy about with niceties here. We've got genocidal wars still taking place.
Well, we've got people getting totally tortured in Guantanamo Bay, you know, and that's
all in the name
breaking,
of all
no,
in the name.
Breaking noses,
yeah,
gouging eyes, squeezing testicles, dousing them with chemicals, you know.
Yeah, we've got all that. In fact, we're going to be playing you a little bit about that shortly.
But folks, the least you could do if you are a professional is go to AE911truth.org. Is that the right address? AE911?
Yeah, AE911truth.org, correct.
Yeah, and that's the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. They've got, 600 or 700 architects and engineers now signed up to the petition. Please, the least you could do is go and sign up to and be a part of of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, because with a bigger body, you know, I mean, we've got more people there than the IPCC has for climate change right now. So
excellent analogy. Yeah. Love it. Yeah. Okay. Well, look. shall we look? Since you alluded to it, let's roll into this this most shocking story that was covered on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! And was also published on Alternet. We'll have the links for you on the webpage. Title of the story by Jeremy Scahill. Little-known military thug squad still brutalizing prisoners at Gitmo under Obama. The black shirts of Guantanamo routinely terrorize prisoners, breaking bones, gouging eyes, squeezing testicles, and dousing them with chemicals. And the worst part about this whole story, right, the thing about it that should make your blood run cold, right, is that from what he's described, and he's done very, very careful research, is that the torture increased after the election of Obama rather than decreased. It actually increased. And even after the inauguration, it continues. It hasn't stopped, folks.
Well, folks, sorry if I could just interject here.
Yeah.
It is a systemic problem, meaning that the system is corrupt, is violent, is disgusting. The system of detaining people preemptively, or people from prisoners of war, and that's what they are, have been, they're just, there's no trial for them. There's no way of them to get trial. You know, now they're sort of mentioning maybe someone will get a trial today on the news. They first said, oh, today the first Al-Qaeda, nice little branding there, boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Terror suspect is going to be tried in a U.S. court, in a civil court. But
it's like saying boogeyman, isn't it? Al-Qaeda, boogeyman.
Yeah. Well, it's a brand.
Yeah.
It's like saying just do it Nike. You know,
yeah.
it's a brand. And the funny thing is, how can you try someone by saying he's a Al-Qaeda, but he's going on trial to see if he's Al-Qaeda? See, it's all just sort of preemptive branding on the part of the mainstream and on the part of, the talk. And in fact, honestly, the scripts are still given by the Pentagon to the mainstream, for these people. So
Josh, your voice is breaking up a little. We're having a little trouble here. I'm just wondering if I might have to reconnect. You've just been breaking up as you speak. We'll just have a quick break and have one reconnect.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin, and half truths. Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Okay, we're back. Are you with us, Josh?
I am. Hopefully we've got a better line.
A stable connection.
Well, seeing as AT&T, we have to go through their whole router system these days and get spied on, so...
Yeah.
Everything's a bit... The whole net's sort of slowing down a bit.
And the boys in the van outside, with the minivan with the sliding door there.
Oh, yeah, Flowers by Irene written on the side.
I sent them a cup of coffee earlier.
Yeah. Put some bananas in their tailpipe.
Courtesy of TNRA, your coffee and burger. Yeah.
So what I was saying is the language that the mainstream uses is still fed to them by the industrial military complexes. It most certainly is. And so shows like this is really good to have. But we're deviating a little bit.
We are. We're not deviating. We're just sort of exploring. But look, we're talking here about tonight. Our lead story is this terrorism from within. the terrorism being conducted by the black shirts of the US military industrial complex justice machine, you know, their facility that they set up to supposedly bring justice. And all it seems to have done, Guantanamo seems to have been just a, on the one hand, it seems to be a place where they experiment to see what they can do to people, to see how what lengths they can go to dehumanize people. And it also seems to be like a culturing place where they can take people, keep them for a few years, and then release them back out again. And, you know, what a great way to create terrorists, eh? I mean, you pick up people who are just randomly, you know, possibly innocent, take them to this place, torture them for several years, then let them go.
Well, a lot of these people are just people, you know, that picked up a gun and, you know, oh, these people in Afghanistan, honestly, they had the Russians, they've had constant war, you know, and there was a little bit of peace, which was totally it wasn't even peace. It was total tyranny by the Taliban. So you had these people who are totally screwed in the head, man. And basically, you know, they hear, oh, we've got more infidels coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they just pick up a gun and go for it. And they're not terrorists. They're just bad. You know, they've just got in their head, far out, more foreigners are coming.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people who are, I mean, what is a terrorist? You know, it's just, it's a vague, you know, it's not a, it can mean anything. It could be a freedom fighter. It could be a, some of them are totally psychopathic. I mean, of course, the ones that are the most dangerous are the ones that have been, you know, had terrible abuse. So the ones that grew up in Palestinian refugee camps, the ones that, you know, so many people come from parts of the world that have been subjected to terrorization for decades. And a lot of these people can be recruited into doing wicked acts.
Nelson Mandela was only just taken off a terrorist watch list.
That's fascinating. You know,
that had been on for years. And he was a terrorist. He was named a terrorist before he got put in jail. I mean, the term terrorism is so vague.
It's just imperial language. It's just language that's used by empire to vilify the people that they don't, you know, that they want to call the enemy. And they like to have that enemy as well. It's not as if they really want to totally, you know, rid the world of these terrorists. They like to have them there. It's useful.
War is terror.
War is
being terrified. War, yeah. Is just standard war procedure.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
That's you know, someone breaking into someone's house is a terrorist because it causes mass terror in the person, you know, that's dealing with this issue. A rapist is a terrorist because he's causing terror. I mean, it's such a vague term.
It is,
and it's, you know, just thrown around the place to basically terrorize you.
You know, 100 years ago, the word that was used in the same way was anarchist. Anarchists were the equivalent of our modern terrorists, and they were, a lot of them were framed as well. A lot of that was just totally set up. You know, the anarchists throwing Molotov cocktails was a theme that was used by governments to justify all kinds of outrageous repression, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the true study of anarchism really has nothing to do with violence. In fact, it's totally peaceful, and they're anti-violent because they believe that government is a force of violence, and that's the only point of government is violence, a monopolization of violence. You know, that's why they take the guns, because they want to have a monopoly on violence.
Well said. Well said. Well, look, at the risk of digressing further, why don't I play a little of this clip from Amy Goodman. Now, Amy, for those of us who aren't familiar, for our listeners, Amy Goodman is the anchor for quite an excellent internet television program called Democracy Now! And, I mean, it's a pretty good show, isn't it, Josh? I mean, like, it's not 100%, and I don't listen to it a lot. I did it one time. I think, you know, but every now and then, you know, she comes good with a really strong story like this. I mean, what I've...
Yeah, they're definitely stuck in a left-right paradigm.
Yeah,
They're still very, you know, so-called, you know, quote, left. But
however,
saying that, yeah. they do come up with some gold sometimes.
I mean, the fact that she's allowed this guy to come on, who's being extremely critical of Obama, suggests that there are some cracks in that facade of left-right, you know. And we need to see more of that. We need to really put an end to this cronyism and this like, oh, I'm a left-wing news person, therefore I'll be really careful about criticizing my, you know, my progressive leftish, you know, political leader, you know. And it's the same here in Australia with Rudd in charge, you know. People get all,
yeah, because
you know, careful
what
about
usually criticizing. What usually happens throughout history is that you've got this sort of left and the right, and what happens, people get angry and angry, like we saw with Bush, you know, anger and anger. And in the past, when you have a dictator, those people eventually go and topple the government, and you know, usually the army or someone puts in a new dictator. But there's a toppling. But if you have a two-party system, you just switch the sides, and all of a sudden everyone's happy again. The system stands up on itself like two pillars standing up against each other, with the sort of New World Order elite, banking monetary elite sitting on top of that.
No, it's outrageous. I can't stomach it, you know, and I'm not going to, all right? I'm not going to stomach this rubbish, okay? Now, look, I'm going to play you a few minutes of Amy Goodman interviewing Jeremy Scahill. So stand by.
Well, there's been a lot of focus on torture under the Bush administration. What about under President Obama? In a new article, investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill writes, the Obama administration's continuing to use a notorious military police unit at Guantanamo that regularly brutalizes unarmed prisoners, including gangs beating them, breaking their bones, gouging their eyes, dousing them with chemicals. This force, officially known as the Immediate Reaction Force, has been labeled the extreme repression force by Guantanamo prisoners, and human rights lawyers call their actions illegal, Jeremy writes. Jeremy Scahill is an award-winning investigative journalist, author of the best-selling book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. His writing and reporting is available at rebelreports.com. Welcome to Democracy Now, Jeremy.
Thanks, Amy.
Well, describe what you call as this little-known military thug squad.
When the Bush administration established the U.S. Prison camp at Guantanamo, of course, we know well that they set up a system where detainees were going to be systematically tortured. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats were briefed on this program, despite what they're saying right now. And while much of the focus has been on the tactical use of torture at Guantanamo, almost no attention has been paid to a parallel force that was torturing prisoners in a variety of ways, including waterboarding them. And that is this riot squad of sorts that you referred to, called the Immediate Reaction Force. The prisoners and their lawyers at Guantanamo call it the Extreme Repression Force. And basically what this is a thug squad that is used to mercilessly punish prisoners who show the slightest bit of resistance or who do things that technically they're not supposed to do. Infractions like having two styrofoam cups in their cell instead of one. Guards will call in this goon squad. They come in with their Darth Vader outfits and they literally gang beat prisoners. There are five men generally that are sent in. Each of them is assigned to one body part of the prisoner, the head, the left arm, the right arm, the left leg, the right leg. They go in and they hogtie the prisoners, sometimes leaving them hogtied for hours on end. They douse them with chemical agents. They have put their heads in toilets and flushed the toilets repeatedly. They've urinated on the heads of prisoners. They've squeezed their testicles in the course of restraining them. They've taken the feces from one prisoner and smeared it in the face of another prisoner. And while Barack Obama, almost immediately upon taking office, issued an executive order saying he was going to close down Guantanamo within a year and that he was going to respect the Geneva Convention while his administration reviewed Guantanamo, this force has continued to operate and torture prisoners under the Obama administration. In fact, in February of this year, about a month after Obama was inaugurated, there were 16 prisoners on a hunger strike at Guantanamo. The immediate reaction force was used to go in and violently shove massive tubes down their noses into their stomachs. And what the IRF teams, as they're called, when they beat someone, it's called IRFing, or to be IRFed up by these teams. They would use no anesthetics or any painkillers, shove this massive tube by force down their nose into their stomach, and then yank it out. Some prisoners have described this as torture, and many have passed out from the sheer pain of this operation.
End of part one, Truth News Radio Australia, 21st of May, 2009.